First of all, I would like to thank you and Gülçin for the invitation here. It is a privilege and an honor to be in Bodrum at the PFS conference. And I hope to tell you something interesting this afternoon. My talk this afternoon comes from a suggestion by Professor Hoppe last year. If you didn't hear his presentation last year, I urge you to do so. It was a presentation about Swiss political scientist, jurist, Karl Ludwig von Haller. He lived from 1768 to 1854, and his main work has the title Restoration of the Political Science. And his main enemies were the theorists of the social contract. So his aim is to destroy the idea that the power comes somehow magically from the people, and there is a sort of delegation of powers from the people to the governments, which is still the foundation of most of our modern states. The social contract is always mentioned, especially during the last years. In a negative sense, the social contract has been broken. But anyway, this is something which we learned from school. There is a social contract. There is a sort of covenant at the basis of all societies. Ludwig von Haller, with his ideas, I will expand on his ideas later during my talk. Wasn't very liked as a thinker. I may mention two very negative remarks on Karl Ludwig von Haller. One by Hegel, who wrote something very interesting. Of course, he said Karl Ludwig von Haller is wrong, and his idea of the state is completely different. And he says something which is very interesting. He said, if the state is confused with a protection agency for property and personal freedom, then membership is just an optional matter. Hegel wrote this, and he said this is why Karl Ludwig von Haller is completely wrong. But I think this is a very interesting remark from a philosopher like Hegel, if you're familiar with his idea of the state as the highest duty of any individual to being a member of the state. Another very negative remark about Karl Ludwig von Haller came from Hannah Arendt in The Origins of Totalitarianism. She said, basically, my fear is, without ever reading Haller, she said he is just an advocate for the ancien regime. He was one of the theorists who tried to find a basis for the restoration. In fact, his main opus, the first volume, was published in 1816, and he wrote the following five volumes. It's a big work until 1834. In fact, Haller doesn't say much about Roman law. This is not the main topic of his research. The main topic of his research are modern states, are the kingdoms, are the princes, are the republics and democracies. And this is what he analyzes, and he tries to find, and in fact, in my opinion, he does find a new theory to explain why states exist and what they do. A theory which is, of course, at odds with the theory of social contract. So Roman law is not his topic, and he just makes a few passing remarks on Roman law. A few passing remarks which are, however, highly intelligent and very interesting. In 10 pages, more or less, he gives a short and brief analysis of Roman law, and especially of the influence of Roman law on modern state theories. First off, he says Roman private law is a very good system. He says it's a treasure trove of very reasonable principles which are valid at all times. And this is the experience that anyone who studied law had with Roman law. Roman law, in fact, is the basis of the modern civil codes. Most countries in continental Europe use civil codes, which are a direct derivation from Roman law. In some countries, Roman law is still applied after 2,000 years. And you may remember the very favorable opinion of Bruno Leoni on Roman law. He said basically that Roman law, with its very slow development through the work of experts, of judges, and the slow accumulation of principles, is maybe a model of libertarian law, of how law would be discovered in a free society. Bruno Leoni says law cannot be posited, it's not the work of a sovereign, but it has to be discovered starting from some basic principles. And this is basically Roman private law, and Haller says the same thing, basically. What is very different is his evaluation of Roman public law, and this is what I find extremely interesting. He said Roman public law influenced very negatively modern thought about the state, and Roman public law may be the culprit, the responsible for the very damaging theory of social contract. He gives a number of reasons why this happens. First of all, the fascination of classical culture. Classical culture is still important for any one of us. We read ancient authors. We are under the spell of authors like Cicero, like the Greek philosophy, like the Roman historians. Latin has been widely used, says Carl Ludwig von Haller. It was the lingua franca during the Middle Ages. In Europe, you spoke Latin, and Latin was the language of academia, of the universities. Until a certain time, no one in his mind would ever think to write something important in French or in Italian or in German, but it was just Latin. Then he makes another very interesting remark. He says, the problem is the adoption of Roman terminology, because if legal theorists talked about the state, they couldn't but use the Latin terms used for public law. And here he says we have a problem, because the Roman terminology is mainly republican. It comes from a republican time, and it was adapted to the Roman Empire. Of course, it was part of the giant propaganda operation of the early emperors, especially of Augustus, to tell the Roman people that the Republic was still there, whereas, Haller says, it was just a usurpation, it was just a military dictatorship. But still, Roman authors continued to use terms which are adapted to a republic and not to a monarchy, like, for example, societas civilis, societas civilis. I have the Italian church pronunciation, so I would say societas civilis, civitates, res publicas, populus, comitia. Patrimonium populi, this is very important, patrimony of the people, public monies, which is, he says, completely illogical with a monarchy. Especially, the idea that he says is that the republican terminology passed over to modern states. And so, in a way, there was this idea, undercurrent, of course, that the states belong to the people. So this is basically what Haller says about Roman law and its influence on modern state thinking. He says this idea that the states are somehow based on the public, on the power of the people, on a sort of transfer of sovereignty from the public assemblies to the magistrates. This is the cause why we had the theories of social contract, and I may mention Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Rousseau, and so on, and the modern idea that the states come out of a sort of a covenant between the people and the structure of power. I would like to expand a little bit on Rome. Why does this idea come from Rome? I think it makes perfectly sense. Ancient Rome, both the age of the kings and the early age of the Republic, may be described as a corporation of robbers. Ancient Rome was based on the idea that might is right, on the idea of conquest, on the idea that the strongest has the right to kill the enemies, to deport them as slaves, to steal their private property. And this was basically the way to do it in ancient Europe. And a city-state like Rome, I'd really like to compare it to a corporation of robbers. The early kings were elective, and it is important to note that one of the most ancient traditions of Roman public law is the so-called Lex de Imperio. It is the law by which, often fictitiously, but anyway, this survived until the age of the emperors, by which the assembly of the people transfers the absolute military power to the kings first and then to the magistrates. It is a very important passage of Roman law, of Roman public law, because even the elected officials, the consuls, the praetors, and so on, they couldn't really exercise their power, especially their military power, without the Lex de Imperio, which was formal but very important. Rome developed during the passage, I would say, a very important passage in ancient military history, because the world passed from a sort of a heroic warfare where there were some champions, some knights who were the strongest in war and the ablest in war. And the history, the story of the Horatii and the Curiatii is a good example of this kind of war making with some champions who fight against each other in a singular fight. To a system of large infantry armies. This happened first with Alexander the Great, who, with his large infantry armies, conquered most of the known world. And this had, as a consequence, the first big struggle between the patricians and the plebeians. Since the nobility and the nobility of war wasn't able to do war anymore because they needed the people, the plebeians managed to get some political clout during a number of revolutions, of secessions, and so on. And during the first period of the Republic, a system developed where there was this corporation managed mainly by the nobility with certain rights of the common people who were mainly armed peasants and who, a part of them, were the upper class of the peasants, or those who could buy and maintain a horse, a war horse. The cavalry was very important during the first time, and then the importance of the cavalry went down in comparison to the infantry. But it was an alliance between nobility and armed peasants with a large number of proletarians who didn't have any importance, not in war and not in the government. Of course, Rome expands it conquers enormous territories, first in Italy and then in the rest of Europe. And the second big clash that develops between the social classes is the one between the soldiers and the armed peasants who participated in the very long and very very tiresome military campaigns of Rome, and the nobility. The clash is about the land. The idea of the nobility was that they had the exclusive right to get the conquered lands, and the plebeians, the soldiers, laid a claim on these lands. And this is the issue of the whole crisis of the Republic, which I would start with the reforms of the Gracchan brothers, the Gracchi, who tried to find a way to distribute the conquered lands to the soldiers. Now I have make a small incurse on Roman military law, which is very important to understand Roman public law. The central concept, which is the concept which still is the origin of our idea of sovereignty, of absolute power, is the concept of imperium. The imperium is the absolute power of the military commander. The Roman commanders, the victorious Roman commanders, are hailed emperors by their soldiers. But anyway, there is a fundamental distinction in Roman public law between what happens in Rome and at a certain distance from Rome, which is called domi, at home, and what happens in the army, milizie. There is this expression, domi militieque, home and military. And the powers of the magistrates and the duties of the subjects were completely different in the two sections. Whereas in Rome, there were certain guarantees from absolute powers. For example, a very important law is the law about the provocatio ad populum. This is the right of appeal of the persons who have been condemned by the highest magistrates, by the consuls, by the praetors, to appeal to the people. And this is a very important guarantee for the Roman citizens. But this works at home, in Rome. It doesn't work in the military, where the power of the military commander is absolute. It is structured on the idea of the power of the ancient pater familias, the head of the family, and it is a power of life and death. It is a disciplinary power, and Rome's armies were very effective in realizing the principle that the soldiers must be way more afraid of their commanders than of the enemies. Roman military discipline was one of the strictest ever put in place. Any soldier could be put to death for the slightest disobedience and for the slightest misgiving in his military duties. And the central concept of Roman power is the concept of imperium, the concept of absolute power. It is the power of war. It is the power of conquest. One very interesting etymology is that of province. Province is provincia, and it means it has been conquered. It comes from vincere, from winning the war. So it is the territory that has been militarily subdued. At a certain point, the equilibrium between the social classes crumbles over the question of the distribution of the lands. And another very important passage in Roman history is the reform, the army reform of Marius. Marius, the opponent of Sulla, he was a very successful military commander, and he was of the party of the so-called populars, the populares, the democrats, like Mommsen says, they had nothing democratic, but anyway. And on the other side, there was the landed nobility. Marius has a stroke of genius, and he decides to let the proletarians, the head count, the so-called capitecensi, get into the army. So the lowest classes of the people can make a career as soldiers. Making a career as soldiers means, of course, taking risks, traveling through whole Europe, but still having part of the booty and having part, especially, of the promise that all Roman generals at the end of the Republic make to their soldiers to have part in the distribution of the lands. The reform of Marius gives rise to the power of the military commanders. It is the origin of what later will become the absolute power of the emperors. We are used to consider Caesar as the first emperor, so-called emperor, and Augustus the real first emperor of the Roman Empire. In reality, the Roman politician who started the empire is Pompey. And there is a very important law in Roman public history, which is the Lex Gabinia de Piratis Perseguendis. It is a law which gave Pompey the absolute power on all the provinces, even on most part of the Italian territory, to set up a very powerful navy to fight the pirates. He is very successful. After winning against the pirates, another law is passed to give him the command in Asia against the king Mithridates, which is the Lex Manilia. And for a number of years, Pompey is the absolute ruler of the Roman, and what we now call the Roman Empire. And this is the first instance of the establishing of a mixture between civil and military power. Pompey is both a civil ruler. He organizes the Asian provinces. He destroys the cities and the strongholds of the pirates. And at the same time, he is the absolute military commander. It is very interesting to note, as on the side, that whereas this happens, or shortly before this happens, there was a revolution going on, a revolution started by a former military commander, Sertorius, who took hold of Spain, and who had some unseemly allies in the pirates themselves, the king Mithridates, who exchanged ambassadors with Sertorius from one side, from Turkey to Spain, and some Celtic tribes who tried to free themselves from the Roman power. And it is an attempt to establish a different world, which is not based on the ruthless exploitation of the provinces. And maybe this is a very modern interpretation, but anyway, to do something to defend freedom against the Roman Empire. Of course, Sertorius is defeated, not militarily, but by a traitor who gives him venom. The Romans win. The Celtic tribes, first in Spain, are completely destroyed, and then afterwards, the example of Pompey is the big example that Julius Caesar follows. It is interesting to note that the first military command of Julius Caesar was in Spain. So the first thing he did was to pacify, according to Roman standards, in reality to subdue completely Spain, which was very important for precious metals and for natural resources. Then he goes back, he is elected consul, and the year after he gets, exactly as Pompey, a special command in Gaul. And he does the same thing as Pompey. Pompey didn't have the courage to go to Rome with his armies. He, at a certain point, this was too much of a constitutional violation for him. But this is exactly what Julius Caesar does. And after Caesar comes back, he takes hold of the state as the first emperor in many regards. But he still thinks that he can come to terms with the landed aristocracy. So he gives lots of pardons. Of course, he is enormously rich because in the meanwhile, he robbed all the gold of Gaul, which was a very rich country. He killed, according to modern statistics, between 1 million and 3 million people there with swords. You must imagine what kind of massacre it has been. And he comes back enormously rich. He changes the world forever because Gaul becomes a Roman province. And he tries to come to terms with the landed aristocracy. He fails because they kill him, as it is widely known. And his successor, Octavianus, and then later Augustus, does come to terms on a completely different basis. He kills them all. This is what he does, basically, through the system of the proscriptions. Prescription means sale of confiscated goods. In practice, this means they are killed, except the few ones who come to terms with the new regime. And what is very important to note from Augustus and Caesar, they change history, they change the past. They are very able propaganda men, and they manage to convince the posterity, even us, that in a sort of way they established the peace. No, the idea of the Pax Romana comes from that time, whereas in fact they are military commanders who manage to establish their ruthless dominion on the world. In a way, what happened at the times of Julius Caesar and Augustus is a great reset which succeeded. We must think of it. The half of the world speaks Romanic languages. In France, you speak French, and in Spain, which is the one of the heirs of the Roman Empire, spread Spanish through all the world. The ancient world was completely destroyed by the Romans. Of course, there are some good things, as I mentioned before, Roman private law, but still, they managed to reset the world completely during these 50, 70 years, which transformed everything. So we have a state which is based on military might, on absolute power. And what is the solution of Karl Ludwig von Haller, to come to him? And this is the conclusion of my speech. What does he think is the foundation of states? He said, princes and republics do not and cannot exercise more power than they would have as individuals. So he bases the power of the states just on private property, on contracts, and basically on a voluntary relationship where someone has the power, but it is no different, says Karl Ludwig von Haller, from the power that maybe an owner has, or maybe the power that someone who has superior knowledge has in his relationships with the ones who want to learn from him. And what is very important is, Karl Ludwig von Haller says, power is always limited by natural law, which means by the law of freedom and private property. And he said, there are three ways to defend yourselves in comparison to abuse of power and to the wrong use of power. The first is religion. So the rulers should adhere to certain religious principles. The second, which is very important in my opinion, is resistance, even violent resistance. So he said, if you can, and if states abuse of their power, you can resist and you can violently resist against them. He says even revenge may be a form of resistance. Third and last resort is flight. But anyway, his states are states based basically on voluntary associations. A few years after Haller wrote his magnum opus, Gustave de Molinari wrote his very important article about the private production of security, and he says there should be competition among governments. I think this goes in the direction of Haller's ideas and in the direction of libertarian ideas. Thank you for your attention.